Members will call the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee meeting to order for February 23rd. The assistant will note the roll as we come in today. Mr. Shetton, and you are first today, right?
Correct.
Okay. Members, we have the minutes before us. Would someone who has looked over the minutes care to move adoption of the minutes? Representative Biskins moves the minutes. Further discussion? Seeing none, let's vote. All in favor signify by aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you, Representative Biskins and members. Well, members, we're going to start the budget presentations. Now the governor's budget is out. We've talked about several things. Hopefully, educationally, bringing you all up to speed on how things work. Now we start through the budget process. You're going to learn, again, try to recall the things about how things work. And please refer to the little cheat sheet that every one of you have in your packet with several thousand acronyms, a couple of organizational charts and flow charts that could be helpful. However, today we have in front of us our friends from the Met Council, so we're kind of starting all over again. So, Mr. Shetton, welcome to the committee. And if you'd introduce your testifiers and your new committee or regional administrator, we'd welcome him to the committee, and you can start your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, my name is Judd Shetton. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk about the governor's recommendation. To my left is our new regional administrator, Pat Bourne. And I will allow him to introduce himself.
Good. Mr. Bourne, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it's great to be here. I'm thrilled to have the chance to speak to you and to have this job and to get to know all of you much better. I'm just going to make some opening remarks and then turn it over to people who actually know something about this topic, which I hope to at someday, but not today.
Well, good luck with that, and we understand exactly how you feel. So, Mr. Bourne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are, our staff is here today to discuss the governor's budget proposal to you for the Metropolitan Council, at least insofar as the general fund is concerned. It's a relatively small amount. I'll speak to the proposal that he has made in just a second, but we understand that this budget proposal of the governor's, the general proposal, is one that requires sacrifice and service reductions across the board that will be painful for all kinds of members of the public, including many of our customers as well. We are going to speak to that, and we'll give you some overview if you're not familiar with the transit service and the variety of transit services that we're in. But it's important to know that the council provides both planning and operating services to the region. Transit services in a densely populated area like the metropolitan region are critical to businesses, their employees, and visitors, but mostly to businesses and their employees. It's critical to these people that they have access to public transportation. For many of them, it's their only means of transportation. I just want to speak to that there were some headlines in the paper today that several of us were involved with, including the chair. It might make you believe that we are ready to make fare increases tomorrow. That would not be true.
Mr. Bourne, I'm sorry I didn't read the paper today. If I said something I should be forewarned about, feel free to comment on that.
But well, there's a headline in one of our newspapers that was picked up by other media sources today that suggest that that we're all coming to you today to announce fare increases, and that is not what we're planning to do today.
I'm very familiar with how that works and how it's like the old game of telephone in junior high, for crying out loud. So
thank you.
The committee is disabused of that notion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll give you
some slack on that one.
Sure, and we'll talk about fare increases and how we do that and what part they play, and you'll see where the fare box is how representative that is in our total revenue picture for transportation and transit. You get a sense for that and our normal way of going about making fare decisions. They are made periodically. The Metropolitan Council does make those decisions. There's a fairly lengthy process for public input, but it's not something that we're planning to do now. It's something that is part of our revenue picture that does represent decisions that we make, but there's nothing imminent. I think if I could just give you a very high-level overview, the governor has recommended a $10.8 million reduction from the general fund's contribution to Metro Transit. This is a 9% reduction in the base appropriation for bus, but I'd also have to say that while it is bus related and there's a bus name on this appropriation, the sales tax on motor vehicle is a revenue that we receive, a portion of that revenue that is collected across the state that we receive and use for a variety of transportation purposes. Let's not get too caught up today in the fact that this is a bus appropriation. We allocate these other revenues that are available for that are available across the portfolio of transit services that we provide, and it represents a reduction to the overall scope of our resources for transportation. I think with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn it over to Arlene McCarthy, who is our general manager in charge of Metro Transit Transportation Services, who will lead you through much of the rest of the presentation today. We have a number of people on our staff who are available for questions. We'll be happy to get back to you with questions if we don't have answers today for you.
Thank you, Mr. Bourne. Any member comments or questions for the new regional administrator before we turn him loose? Thank you. We'll look forward to having you back again sometime, Mr. Bourne. Ms. McCarthy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Arlene McCarthy, and I'm Director of Metropolitan Transportation Services at the Met Council. I'd like to just provide a little bit more detail to Mr. Bourne's comment about how a funding reduction will impact all of our services. What you see here on this slide is what we call the family of public transit services here in the metropolitan area. I think you're familiar with most of them, but it's important for you to know that we manage funding of these services collectively. So we really view them as a package. I think you're aware that there are different rules that apply to different components. The one that I would highlight that is really important for you to understand is that Metro Mobility is our ADA service, and therefore we do have federal ADA laws with which we must comply. And also back in 2006, the legislature established a footprint of these services, so there are some special legal requirements associated with Metro Mobility. Mm-hmm. We would really like to highlight for you the excellent service that we provide here in public transportation. I think you know that per a legislative requirement, every other year we do a transit performance report at the Met Council where we look at different performance measures, and consistently the council and the transit service here in this region has performed very well compared to our peer regions. We typically use 11 peer regions that have transit systems similar to us, that would have light rail, dial-a-ride, that type of thing. And very recently, just last month, the U.S. News and World Report did have an article that ranked the transit properties across the country, and we were very pleased that Minneapolis-St. Paul was rated fifth by this. And so that, I think, just is the continuing message that we do have a high-performing system here. When we look at some of our key efficiency measures, our ridership growth has outpaced our peers across the country, and our subsidy per trip is significantly lower than our peers across the country. We also periodically, I think it's every other year, we do customer surveys, and we're very happy that consistently more than 90% of our customers are pleased with the service that we are providing. I think you all know that ridership is dependent on service levels out there. The level of service really impacts how attractive the service is, the number of trips for people to use, how long they have to wait for the next bus. And so as we talk about our service funding level, that of course directly impacts the amount of service that we can provide on the street. As Mr. Bourne said, this transit is very important to a variety of folks. Most of our transit riders, based on the survey that I just mentioned, are going either to work or school. Of course, there are other trips involved, but the majority are going to work or school. And also, the majority ride during what we call the commuter or peak hours. And of course, that is when congestion on our roads is also the highest. And so transit does provide an important mitigation for congestion on our roads. We've had some actually the Downtown Council of Minneapolis has conducted some research. And through that research, it demonstrates that 40% of workers going to downtown Minneapolis use transit. So of course, this is primarily in the peak. And we have confidence in this number because it's been validated by other work by the city of Minneapolis when they do some transportation counting and measuring of people coming into the cities. And this is very important because the impact it has on our roads. For example, on I-35W, which is one of our highest peak transit ridership corridors, if the folks who are on transit were instead driving alone, that would equate to another lane and a half of traffic. So there are trade-offs that transit provides with our highway system.
Ms. McCarthy,
yes.
Could you remind us what your definition of the twin peak times are? I know there's a morning rush and evening rush. Remind us of the times.
Yes, I believe that the morning rush hour is from 6 a.m. until 9, yeah. And the afternoon is from 3 until 6:30. Yes. Okay.
3 to 6:30.
So the half hour, excuse me, the afternoon is a half hour longer. It's 3.5 hours, and the morning is 3 hours.
And when you use the lane and a half analogy, mm-hmm. Using an assumption of so many cars per hour per lane, what number are you using on that? Do you remember?
About 2,500.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And then again, as I mentioned, Mr. Chair, we do a survey, and so we know this. That many of our riders are choice riders, that they do have a vehicle that would be an option to them, but they choose to take transit, and that they can also afford to drive alone, so to speak. This chart here shows our transit ridership over about the last decade. And I'd like to highlight the low bar and the high bar on this chart. First, 2004 was a low ridership year for us because of the transit strike, the bus operator strike that we had in that year, and that is why that is low. 2008 is our high year, and I think all of you will recall that it was in 2008 that gas prices were in the $4 a gallon ballpark, and that caused a spike in ridership. And so that's something that's on our minds here as we watch fuel prices in the near future. But in general, our transit ridership is at its highest point historically, even though there have been some changes overall. We're at pretty strong ridership here in the region.
Ms. McCarthy, would you pause for a question, please?
Yes.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCarthy, it's been a while since I sat on the Transportation Committee, so forgive me. But I'm going to link the last two pages together. On slide number 5, the second bullet says that transit impacts congestion levels. And then in the next slide, we talk about 2004 during the bus strike. Mm-hmm. Ms. McCarthy, was there any analysis during the bus strike as to length of trip? Anecdotally, I heard from a number of my constituents who drive from Scott County into the metro area that they actually thought the freeways flowed smoother without the buses, freeways and streets. So did the Met Council do any analysis of congestion during the bus strike period?
Ms. McCarthy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. There was not a formal analysis. I know that MnDOT, as we know, has all of that type of data that is available. I do recall at that time there was quite a bit of attention given ahead of the strike that it potentially could occur. I do recall that some of the anecdotal analysis was that people temporarily changed their habits, their starting times. We did notice that the peak spread out significantly, that people came to work earlier because there was the anticipation of changes in congestion due to that. But, Mr. Chair, to answer your question, there was not a formal analysis done, no.
Representative
Business Bolo. Well, then I wonder if from the testimony it wouldn't logically seem that people's behavior has even greater impact on congestion than how many buses we may own or how many rail lines we may develop. Would that be a fair analysis?
Okay, answer, or if it take it as a comment or rhetorical, or I will notice that after the 35W disaster, one of the immediate plans that MnDOT made in conjunction with Met Council was that we're going to have horrible congestion, and boy, the citizens who had to move themselves around were actually quite adaptable, which I think was something that surprised some of our urban planning friends, that just how adaptable and adjustable people could be given the reality they had to work with. So that is a thought to note as we move forward, but you're free to comment or respond to Representative Biskin's question and comment.
Mr. Chair and members, I appreciate Representative Biskin's comments, and we'll follow up with him. We don't have that analysis, and and I think maybe further discussion regarding his question is probably in order.
This would be a good spot for Representative Szymanski, who has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And also on slide number 5, looking at the 40% of downtown Minneapolis workers use transit, I've had to park downtown, and I know what kind of a hassle that is, and I can appreciate those workers, using the mass transit system. But I also know that the cost of parking downtown is substantial. So with that in mind, and also talking about the next two bullet points down there, about 50% of LRT riders have household incomes above $50,000. My concern is, are we saving them substantial amount of money by their access to mass transit? And in that respect, could we ask them to pay a higher fare for riding the mass transit system into the downtown area?
Ms. McCarthy or Mr. Shetland?
Mr. Chair, Representative Szymanski, as we mentioned earlier, that the governor's recommendation, we're looking at a variety of ways of addressing our reduction. And based on your question about whether or not the fare structure should be looked at for Hiawatha, we're really not considering that at this point. If things were different, we may have to look at things a bit different. However, we feel that our fare structure that we have set up at this point is consistent with what other urban areas or our peer groups have. And we appreciate that folks use our transit system. We think it's a positive thing that they will use that to take it downtown, because you're correct that parking in downtown Minneapolis is extremely expensive, and that is one of the advantages. We find that really specifically when we talk about special events with people who want to take the train, say, to the Twins game or to the Vikings game or to an event at the Metrodome, and we think that is an important part of this. But to answer your question specifically, we're not considering the fare increase at this point. Depending on what the February forecast looks like, depending on what the legislature puts forward for their budget recommendations, and depending on where we come to an agreement at the end of the legislature, will have a much, I guess, bigger impact on where our budget and the activities that the council will have to undertake in order to make this budget work. And I guess I'd like to leave it at that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the questions that have been raised today probably deserve one session to answer, and there are representatives in the audience that I hope are noting those questions, because I've heard that that you have answers to give, and I would hope you might ask the chair for an ability to testify on all the work you have done on these particular questions. But I think it would be helpful at this point to say that the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, in fact, have done work on the return from Minnesota's investment in transit. And they report that every $1 invested in public transit results in $6 of economic return. These benefits include reduced congestion, reduced cost of operating cars, so that's a good thing, reduced pollution, and increased safety. So there's a huge amount of work done on the very questions raised. And frankly, I hope that one of the sectors that weighs in this year, as some of these questions are raised, is the business community, the very biggest business players who travel the world and who can tell us what every other major metropolitan area is doing and what cities around the world are doing. And the only way we continue to be economically competitive as a region is if we look different in transportation in the future than we did in 1950.
If we would put $1 billion into transit, would that solve our $6 billion deficit, Representative? I'm just messing with you, but I hear what you're saying. But members, it's we hear several of these, and we need to, you're right, we need a whole session to drill down into what that then means, because I'm thinking about investments in early childhood education and Head Start and several other things we do. At the end of the day, though, what we want to be is as mobile as possible for the dollars we have to spend, and that's kind of what we're going to hear Met Council talk about, how they're going to keep us as mobile as we can be.
Right.
With the dollars that we have to spend and the cuts the governor is proposing. Further questions or comments, we'll ask Ms. McCarthy to please proceed.
Mr. Chair, thank you. To follow on your point, I think you're very right that we are always looking to make sure that every dollar that we get is spent wisely. Mm-hmm. And it's a matter of course for us to always be seeking efficiency improvements in our service. And I think we have a pretty good track record of that. And today we would like to highlight a few of the more recent ones for you. The first three items listed on this slide really deal with technology, really a great way over the last decade that we've been able to improve our service and reduce our costs. We invested in a upgraded service scheduling system. That is really how all the work is put together into pieces of work for the operators to then drive. And we invested in this system and had very good results. Basically, we were able to take the same work we were performing, and we saved approximately $2.6 million and had 50 less operators on staff to deliver the same work. And that was just a reflection of investing in some new technology. And of course, that's a year in and year out savings that we now realize. Secondly, we've invested in GPS technology on all of our fleet. We call this the AVL, or Automatic Vehicle Location System. And what this does is it tracks the running time of our buses. We can see how long it actually takes to get from point A to point B every day. This then becomes valuable information for us to adjust our schedules to the actual running time. And so it provides better customer service as well as efficient of routes as we can possibly provide. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. And the last technology component I'd like to highlight is our electronic fare collection system. We have some kind of interesting videos that show when everything was manual, people putting in their card and it coming out of the fare box, the older way of doing it with now our new proximity go-to cards. People can literally keep on walking as they get on the bus and tap their card as they board. And we have many people who use MetroPass, and at the U we have UPass. And so that has really speeded up what we call the boarding time. So all of these things collectively have helped us speed up our service, provide better customer service, and keep our service as efficient as possible.
Ms. McCarthy,
yes.
I'm just going to ask Mr. Shetland to take a note that at some point we'd like to have a little brief discussion about how you got into that program, how much it costs, and how effective it's been. Because we're having a problem with another division that's trying to institute a new computer program that seems to be really bogged down in the weeds. And it might be helpful at that time. So I don't want to get you too far off track. I just want Mr. Shetland to know we're thinking about that.
Okay.
Thank you.
And then the last two items, hybrid buses and biodiesel fuel, of course, focus on energy efficiencies. 11% of Metro Transit's fleet is hybrid buses. That's 97 of their total 885 buses. Having some experience now operating with hybrid buses, they have documented that there's a 21% improved fuel efficiency compared to regular diesel buses. So these are very good to use on local routes where there's a lot of starting and stopping, which is your effective use of hybrid technology. So for example, in 2010, Metro Transit drove 800,000 more miles of bus service, yet they used 600,000 gallons less of fuel. So you can kind of see the benefit that we are getting with these hybrid buses. And then also, Metro Transit is a leader with biodiesel fuel. The percent share of biodiesel used varies over the course of the year due to changing weather conditions, but they have used up to 20% biodiesel. And of course, as you know, this lessens our dependence on foreign fuel. But we're not stopping there. We continue to work with the U of M on other energy enhancements. And I think this is very important because Metro Transit is the largest consumer of diesel fuel in the state of Minnesota. So being a leader in this efficiency really has great benefits. So again, that was just to highlight a few of our recent efficiencies. Now this chart shows our workforce efficiencies over the last few years. And just to highlight on the bus line there, you'll see the first subtotal of MTS and Metro Transit bus. Between our budget of 2011 and our actual of 2002, we have reduced the bus operating workforce by 9.5%. During this same period, the bus service, actually the bus ridership, stayed essentially flat, if you recall from that ridership chart. So I think that speaks well to we have been able to deliver good service but yet reduce our operator workforce count. Then, of course, we also added two new modes of Hiawatha LRT and Northstar Commuter Rail, which took substantial new areas of expertise and new employees. But when we wrap this all up into a total picture, you will see that our change in workforce is actually decreased while we continue to add new modes. But yet, during that time period of 2002 to 2011, overall we grew ridership by more than 16%. So this demonstrates that we are working hard to implement service in the right areas and working hard to provide cost-efficient service. Mr. Chair, we did present this information when we were here before you back in January. We just thought it would be good to remind folks of what our revenue sources are and our expenses. Of course, today we're talking about the State General Fund. You can see on the orange slice there, it's about 14% of our 2011 operating revenue budget. And I'd like to call your attention to the largest piece there, the red, which is the motor vehicle sales tax at almost half of our budget revenues. So we'll be talking about motor vehicle sales tax and just want to keep you anchored on how large a share that is. We do have some financial uncertainties. Fuel prices, I know everybody in this room, I'm sure, is aware of the uncertainty with fuel prices. They really are volatile. Some are projecting prices to again rise to the $4 a gallon rate. And Metro Transit does consume about 7.2 million gallons of fuel a year, so an increase in this does have a very large impact on our budget. We do try to provide some budget certainty by using using fuel forward pricing on a share of our budget. Again, ultimately, we pay the market price, but doing a share of our fuel in this pricing mechanism does allow us, at least for the near-term, budget certainty. So we have found that to be very, very helpful.
Ms. McCarthy, I think the discussion on fuel has spurred a couple of questions.
Okay.
Representative Morrow?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, you're probably noticing the same thing in your area, although I know in my area I'm starting to hear about some of our local governments talking about getting rid of transit as a way to balance their budgets. Mm-hmm. But what I remember noticing, Mr. Chair, is when gas got to $4 a gallon, people were riding their bicycles between St. Peter and Mankato. So I'm wondering what the what might be the perfect storm, if you will, of as fuel prices go up for you, there are pressures on Metro Transit. At the same time, I have to imagine ridership demands go up as fuel prices go up. Am I right in understanding those two combined together to actually stress the system even more?
Ms. McCarthy?
Chair Beard and Representative, yes, you're absolutely right. And that is what, back on that ridership bar chart, the year 2008 demonstrated just the situation that you described. Our costs go up to deliver the service, yet the demand for the service concurrently increases.
Related to that, Ms. McCarthy, before I go to Ms. Representative Benson, on the pie chart, I'm not looking or seeing where we got a Metro Transit slice of the pie. It's kind of lemon meringue yellow there.
Mm-hmm.
What portion of your expenses would be considered fuel? How big an impact does it have on? I'm sure labor is a large cost. Insurance is probably big. How big is fuel? And when it rises a buck a gallon, how big a swing does it have?
Mr. Chair, fuel is about 8% of the budget. I believe it is the second largest component of the budget behind the labor.
Okay.
And the pricing, every 10-cent increase in fuel equates to about an $800,000 annual budget increase for Metro Transit.
That's significant. Members, just note that. Representative Benson, I'm sorry, I cut ahead of you there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wish my colleague, Representative Banyan, would hear as the economist, because I maybe see it a little bit differently in that maybe some forecasting or modeling that could be or should be done to, since you have some historical data and the fluctuations of the price of gas and how it affects ridership, it's like anything, but if you've got typically bus, I would imagine at least that you have many buses that are not completely full, and certainly your gas goes up, but it drives people more people onto the bus, and it increases the revenue. My expectation is that you'd already be trying to do some modeling on how actually that may improve your profitability and affect the amount of revenue in a positive way to come in. Now, there might be a certain point in that where people aren't quite ready to give up their car at this point, but if things keep going like they're projected to $4, I think I would be anxious to see that if I were you from a revenue standpoint. Can you explain, do you have economists that are working on that modeling so that you could see how that would work?
Either of you?
Mr. Chair, we do have some historical data. We do use modeling. Basically, we have to look at the specific situation. And as you said, there are trade-offs. But historically, we have found every time we have a fare increase, there is a drop in ridership. I mean, there are many factors that come into play.
Follow up, Representative Benson.
Yeah, I guess I'm not talking about a fare increase. I'm talking about a price increase in gasoline.
Oh, in fuel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, one of the issues is that when the cost of fuel goes up and people transfer to using the bus system, there is an additional cost on that route once that bus is full, because then we have to put additional service on that route. And as you can tell, we have most of our services done through the peak periods. And those routes are running extremely full right now. And so there is an additional capital cost and there's an additional operating cost. And the fare recovery does not cover that entire cost. And so there is an additional pressure put on our system. And we are proud of our system and we want to be able to react to be able to providing those routes. But it is extremely difficult under those constraints because, again, fuel prices go up. People do not purchase cars. They want to get out of their cars. Our system is funded through the motor vehicle sales tax. So motor vehicle sales tax receipts go down. And then there more people gravitate over to the transit system, and we find ourselves in a really difficult position where we have people who want to use the transit system where we find ourselves in the position of struggling with trying to be able to provide that service. your comments are not lost on me. I understand what you're saying. I will be happy to talk to our folks at Metro Transit and see what has been done and circle back with you, because I think that is a fair point. But I also want the committee to be aware that there is an impact felt on our system when a bus is full. We can't add on to that bus. We have to provide an additional service.
Another follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I sense that you're getting that, but I'm also getting a sense that you haven't done modeling in the past, and I would think it would really provide some real advantages to you going into the future in terms of planning for, but getting a sense of the opportunities that exist if energy costs do go up. 10 years ago, the airline industry, somebody came out with an algorithm that says, you know, we need to fill up every seat, and if we can do that by lowering the cost of the seat, even a day before, we're going to make a whole lot more money. And my sense of this whole thing is that we just need to make sure that we're maximizing the routes and having as many people on that and on those buses. I mean, you're going to get to some point rail that I have even a bigger problem with in terms of the subsidies related to the amount of people that are on them. But I'll stop and say thank you, and I look forward to seeing the results of the work on that modeling.
And Mr. Chair, members,
Mr. Chetnan,
I appreciate that, and we will have that discussion. So, thank you.
Going forward, we have some more transit discussions. At some point, you may want to discuss the how it works with twin peaks of what we used to have about 900 buses on the street in the morning and evening peaks, and a couple hundred in the middle, and the difficulties of scheduling and working that whole system might be something. The difference between regular route versus express bus and so on would be helpful for the members to understand. Representative Leidiger.
Well, my question was pretty much covered by Representative Benson, but
okay.
We got to recognize there's a lot of moving parts, and it would seem to me that we should have this algorithm already, and it should be in terms of total capacity, and I would think that if we, you know, the way we were discussing it in terms of for every dollar or 10-cent increase in fuel, what does that do to our capacity and profitability? That's all.
Okay. Thank you. This is a good moment to break in here. I like to recognize former members when I spot them in the audience, if I recognize you. We have the former chair of the Transportation Committee, former Representative Ron Earhart, has joined us over here today. Ron, welcome back. Well, thank you. You always were interested in transportation. We're glad to see you here today. And Schreiber, I'm not ignoring you. I'll talk about you one of these days. But Ms. McCarthy, please proceed before I get myself in any more trouble with former members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we'll move on to AmVest performance. You'll remember that about half of our revenues are from motor vehicle sales tax. First, we have a slide here that looks at the statewide MVEST revenues. And you'll recall that back in 2003, we shifted transit operations from property tax to motor vehicle sales tax. And while we don't have pre-2003 on this slide, it was steadily growing until this year. And in 2003, it unfortunately started a pretty steady decline, as you can see here on this chart. So, we do have, there's some dashed lines on this chart where we have shown some of the previous forecasts, and you can see that traditionally the forecast has shown that there would be a rebounding in motor vehicle sales tax. Unfortunately, that rebounding hasn't really occurred over the course of the last few years. The good news is just between 9 and 10 was the first time there was an uptick, a very modest uptick in this revenue source. And so we just always have, we're anxious, I guess is the best word to use, about the forecast as it comes out. Yes, that might have been, Judd was just mentioning that there was the special federal funding program for people to buy autos, and that's probably what was causing that uptick between 09 and 10. So then we ask ourselves, is that kind of a one-time phenomenon? What will happen with the future forecast? So this is very important to us, given that it's about half of our funding, and we're always looking forward. And of course, as you know, next week will be the February forecast for the motor vehicle sales tax.
Mr. McCarthy, just to be clear, this we're looking at this chart on page 11. This is the total MBEST revenues collected. This isn't the part that's been moved over from the general fund. So we're seeing the entire motor vehicle sales tax collections dropping by precipitous amount here.
That's a very good way to describe it, Mr. Chair.
And if I can just add real quick, Mr. Chair, and one of the concerns we talk about, and when we pointed out the motor vehicle sales tax portion of the budget that we receive, is that the legislature in the state puts forward budget decisions based off of those forecasts.
Yes.
And the point of this is to show that those forecasts have not met forecasts almost every time, except for this last uptick. And again, that was the, we're thinking the Cash for Clunkers program may have something to do with that. But there's also needs to be kept in mind that when a number of people go out to buy cars, then they're not going to purchase one for quite a while down the road.
Yep.
So just to keep that in mind, and you're right, this is to talk about the overall function of that motor vehicle sales tax. And it also goes to show that what one percentage of a motor vehicle sales tax amount is worth considerably less today than it was anticipated in 2003. Mm-hmm. And as the forecasted amounts show, we've just never quite got there. So there is that volatility that is, you know, chief among our concerns.
Representative Murray has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like the forecast down here is pretty optimistic. I'm not quite sure that GM and Ford are sharing the same sales projections here. Can you explain to me how we're looking at roughly a 40% increase in revenues over the next, by 2015?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I appreciate your comments. The state performs these forecasts, and that is who we work with. While we have expressed some concern, these are the forecasts that we work with. I think if you were to go back in time and use and look at the previous forecast versus actuals, we might share that same comment that you have.
Thank you.
We use Global Insight as well for this, don't we?
Yes.
They do the state forecasting for the big budget, and they do these for us as well.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Representative Szymanski has a comment or question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shetland, what percentage of the MVEST money is going to transit right now?
That's covered on the next slide.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're going to cover that on the next slide here, but I will tell you that when you ask about transit, the motor vehicle sales tax statutorily split 60-40 between roads and transit. Mm-hmm. Metropolitan Area Transit gets 36%, and Greater Minnesota Transit gets 4%. And in this next slide, Ms. McCarthy is going to show that we are actually at our phased-in amount. After the constitutional amendment passed, we were making that phase-in, and in this budget cycle, we reach our 36%. And going back to the previous question, that is where we have that additional concern, because we are fully phased in at that point, so we are even more at the mercy of this volatile funding. So I'll let Ms. McCarthy go into that.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, this slide shows the regional share of motor vehicle sales tax. You will see down on the bottom, right below the year, is the share of the motor vehicle sales tax of the statewide amount that is coming to the metropolitan area for transit operations. So it is phasing in over 5 years, and by 2012 you will see we will be at the full 36%. And so, as Judd has just mentioned, our share has increased from 2003 to 2010 from 20.5% up to 31.5%. In other words, the percent increase has grown by 50%. However, because the collections have dropped so much, our the statewide collections during this period actually decreased, such that our regional motor vehicle sales tax collections were only 17.8 million more, or 14%. That's okay. So it's just very important. What, as I would like to emphasize what Judd has said, is that what has really helped over the last 4 years is that we have gotten an increasing share of motor vehicle sales tax, yet because the revenues dropped, it really didn't pay off as was originally anticipated. The good news is that this increase in share in motor vehicle sales tax did help offset some other general fund reductions. We had an increase of $19.3 million. You remember the slight increase we had between 2009 and 2010, the one uptick year for us. We did have an increase there of $19.3 million. However, that was more than offset by a reduction in state general fund appropriations of $21.5 million during that same time frame. So we got more MVEST, but we lost an even greater amount of state general fund during that time period. Mm-hmm. So now moving on to our situation with our state general fund. This kind of gives the recent recap of how much we have received here in the region.
Ms. McCarthy, Representative Benson has, or I'm sorry, Murray has a question.
I'd like to go back to the last slide just for a second there. I'm questioning whether, as your amount has moved up to 36%, and you'd mentioned the Greater Minnesota amount being 4%, has that been shrinking, what's been going to Greater Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Shetnan, Representative Murray, I know the folks from MnDOT are here, but let me take a quick stab at this. I think the amount has been shrinking, the equivalent of what our shares have been shrinking, because the worth of that percentage of MVEST has been reduced. The share has remained the same, or their percentage has remained the same, but the actual worth of that share is what has been reduced. And so we've always said we've been receiving an ever-increasing share of an ever, how do we say that?
Shrinking pie.
An ever-decreasing, a larger slice of a shrinking pie.
Yes.
That's how we say it.
Just a quick follow-up then is,
Representative Murray.
Mr. Chairman, so whose part of the pie is shrinking as you've moved up to 36%?
Well, Mr. Chetnan, I think it's the whole pie is shrinking.
That's right.
The ratios of the slices stay the same, just the pie is getting a little smaller. So.
All right, thank you.
That's correct.
Well, actually, to be accurate, Mr. Chetnan, would it be fair to say the pie is not getting as big as we thought? It's still a little larger than it was as far as the money coming into the transit pool, but it isn't as big as we had been planning on when we made this shift in 2003, I believe. Would that be an accurate statement?
Mr. Chair, I think you're close, but as far as MVEST, you may be right, but then we've also been taking reductions in our general fund.
That is,
so,
thank you, yes.
That just needs to be kept in mind for the whole picture.
Representative Morrow, you want to comment to that?
Well, Mr. Please. Chair, I think Mr. Shedden and I are going to be saying the same thing. But Representative Murray has a good point. If a percentage is increasing, doesn't that have to be coming from somewhere else? Part of the MVEST was going to the general fund. It's the general fund portion that's shrinking as the transit portions went up.
Yes, thank you. Ms. Zewers might be able to shed some a staff light on the discussion here.
Mr. Chair and members, as Representative Morrill said, the general fund piece has been shrinking. It was 16.25% last year. It's currently 6.25%, and then in fiscal year 2012, it'll be zero.
Okay, is that... shed a little light on the situation. Representative Leidy, do you still have a comment or your question answered?
Well, what makes up for that then? That shrinkage, I think that's what I'm...
Yeah, and that's the problem we're having here. Yeah, they're moving general fund money away from transit for other purposes because of the economic difficulties we're in. We're leaning more and more on a pie that's not as big as we thought it was going to be when we initiated this whole thing in 2003. That is the conundrum we're having. So,
thank you for that explanation. That helps me.
That's why we're paying rapt attention to this presentation, because we're going to have some choices to make here in a couple weeks, members.
Thanks.
So, we appreciate everybody's attention and creative thinking and input. So, everybody else okay for a moment? Let's ask Ms. McCarthy to proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this slide does show the recent history of the State General Fund contribution to our transit operations. And then we do show the governor's recommendation here, a reduction. And so our total would be 59.6 under the governor's proposal. I think, as you just summarized, Mr. Chair, we at the council do understand that the state is facing difficult conditions. We know that there are many difficult choices that have to be made for many programs at the state level. And we've explained to you the impact to transit here today. And we know that any cut will be difficult, but we also know that it is the council's responsibility to manage that. And I think Mr. Bourne explained that to you when he introduced this topic, that the new Met Council will be seated, and it's something that the new Met Council will simply need to deal with. So we have, I think that that has been accepted at the council.
Just for a timeline. Ms. McCarthy, the letter I think we all got from the governor indicated he was hoping for a new council to be posted by March 7th. And as we're moving our way through this, I'm thinking the forecast we're required to work with will come out about March 3rd, new council about the 7th. Thinking about when we want to be digesting this and making our passing a bill out of this place. Maybe I'm just speaking out loud on the timeline. If you'd like to comment on it or something, feel free. But
Mr. Chair, I could speak to that.
Certainly.
The February-March forecast, I believe, is coming out next Monday. February
28th? 28th. Come out in February this year.
Yes, okay, the new Metropolitan Council we expect to be seated, to be announced Monday, March 7th. I think they'll be sworn in at our first council meeting on Wednesday, March 9th. The governor is required to file a notice of intent to appoint forms through the open appointments process with the Secretary of State on Wednesday, March 2nd, which is a week from today, so that should give us a pretty good idea of who the governor is looking at for seating in the new council. So by Wednesday, March 9th, we will have that council on board, and we will be again doing a crash course in budgeting. As you know, the council is much bigger than just the transit system.
Yes.
But seeing that this is an issue of immediate importance, I'm sure we will be doing, like I said, a crash course in transportation funding and transit funding. And I talked with the committee administrator just prior to this meeting, and I talked about the timeline that your committee was going to be looking at in order to make your recommendations by the committee deadlines that have been set by House and Senate leadership. So we will be available to talk about any of these scenarios. Obviously, we are endorsing the governor's position on this, and would like the committee to consider that.
Of course. Let me call upon former Met Council member Representative Hornstein.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And just on this topic, I just wanted to confirm with you and other members that is it your expectation or understanding that we'll have a budget leaving this committee by March 25th? Is that
Representative Hornstein, yeah, that's the target we've been given to do. So I'm thinking about the new Met Council dealing with their business and getting this done all at the same time. It's going to be a little intense, and I kind of like to save it a little more towards the end of March so at least they have had a fair chance to go through it and so on.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, Ms. McCarthy, take another stab at it and see how far you get before we ask you more questions.
Mr.
This
Chair,
is good stuff. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad you appreciate that. Thank you. We think so, too. Just to kind of help you understand our priorities and next steps, I think you've done a good job of summarizing. I think I'll go to the last bullet on this slide first, which is we've talked a lot about the monitoring of the MVES performance. And as you just said, we are going to be watching very closely for the forecast that comes out next week. And that is really a big deal considering what a large share of its funding we get from motor vehicle sales tax. So very critical in our performance. But I want you to know that at the council, maintaining the existing service on the street is a priority for us. We also like to seek structural solutions. And what we mean by that is we like to have long-term solutions, something that can be sustained over time, as opposed to maybe a one-time short-term solution that needs to be solved again and again. And so our goal is to seek structural solutions. We'll, again, as we'll have to see what we can come up with. And then we always look at all of the regional budgets, look for whatever we can do to provide some efficiencies and some savings. So, Mr. Chair, I believe that brings us to the end, and we'll be happy to take more questions.
Well, thank you for indulging us with questions and comments while you were making comments that were inspiring and inciting questions in our minds and so on. This has been a good discussion, and I see through my rearview mirror that Representative Hornstein has another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate very much both of your presentations, and I was especially pleased when Mr. Bourne said that you know, a fare increase isn't necessarily at this time on the table for the Met Council. And, you know, I guess reaching back in history, we had a fare increase when I was on the council in 2001, and then I think there was another one in 03, 05, then 08. Chair Bell had that proposal, I think, for a two-tiered kind of increase, and so there was one in effect in 08. And then, interestingly, he chose, I believe, in 2009 not to go with an additional fare increase, which was a decision that I applauded. Because, you know, when you increase fares, it's kind of like one step forward, two step back. Ridership declines, so the progress we make, then we step back. We already have, I think, among the highest fares in the country. And so, again, knowing that this isn't on the table, at least now, and I appreciate that, I hope that there are other tools in your toolbox that you can use besides a fare increase to address this deficit. And I don't know if you can discuss that, if you have other ideas about where you may go at this point. You know, I know that there are some, you know, some levy. There's room with the levy. We have the transit revenue enhancement areas of South Anoka County and parts of Dakota County that aren't, you know, there's some possible revenue that can be raised there, and those areas have transit service but aren't paying for it. So I'm wondering whether you've discussed or thought through beside the fare increase how you may be addressing this.
Mr. Shetland?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, thank you for your comment. I think that the council would like to wait to see what the outcomes of the February forecast will look like. I think we'd also like to talk to our new council to see what the flavor is regarding some of the difficult decisions that looks like we're going to be faced with. And again, we'll be happy to come back to the committee at that point. Today we wanted to go through what the governor's recommendation was. And I think to look at the last slide that we had, that these are our priorities for dealing with this situation. And again, we want to maintain our existing service. We want to seek structural solutions. I think that is very important because one-time fixes are just that. And then we need to re-examine all regional budgets, because when we talk about this, it needs to be looked at in the context of all the providers and service that we provide through the region. So if the committee would accept that, we would prefer to wait to see what adjustments are made based on that the upcoming forecast, and then obviously we'll have a discussion with whatever the legislature puts forward, and we'll go with it that way.
Thank you. Representative Szymanski. Representative Hornstein,
I'm done. Thank you.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may just back up to slide number 13 on state transit funding. In the yellow area there, we'll see in 2010 we had a $70 million budget, and then with budget cuts in 2011 we dropped down to 49.2, and now 12 and 13 we're projecting it at $65 million. How did you manage that severe budget cut in 2011? What changed in the system?
Just
Mr. Shannon.
Mr. Chair, just one. Can I talk?
Phone a friend? Yes, you may
do
that.
We're going to have our.
Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
I can tell you exactly what happened.
Okay.
Yes.
Amazing, huh?
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, what happened during that period of time was that there was an acceleration of MBEST done at that point, where Greater Minnesota Transit and Metropolitan Area Transit received some additional MBEST at that point, and then there was a subsequent exchange there. And part of that was done because of the ERA funds, or the stimulus funds. I believe MnDOT received about $500 million worth of money, and so in order to wrap up this budget, it was a trade-off was done between giving Greater Minnesota Transit, Metropolitan Area Transit, about a total of $19 million
of MnDOT's MBEST, and then we were able to wrap things up.
I was privileged to be the minority member on the conference committee that year when we were discussing these things, and I remember the intense, heartfelt, and good faith discussions that went, negotiations back and forth between Chair Bell and yourself, Mr. Shetland, and Representative Hornstein, Representative Morrow, I think, were on that. Mm-hmm. And it amazed me that you pulled this off without the fare increase and without, I don't think, even tapping the RALF funds or the Livable Community funds that we authorized you to do to try to maintain service levels. So, nice work. And now you tell the rest of the story about how that happened. So, yes. Further comments or questions before we turn these good folks loose and move on to public safety? Thank you. Well, we'll look forward to having you back after the February forecast, and you get your new folks seated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last thing. We'll make sure that we circle back regarding those questions that were asked of us today prior to any budget decisions being made. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. While they're coming, let me just do a couple of housekeeping things. Tonight is Greater Mankato Day down at, who's here from Mankato area? Terry? You want to take a moment to run an advertiser? Oh, cool jacket, by the way.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I know that folks are here in the Capitol from 3 to 5, and then 5:30 at the Hilton Garden Inn in downtown St. Paul, and shuttle buses will be running, provided by the soybean growers.
Well, there you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I can say, because I can never find the Hilton Garden Inn on my first pass, so I'll be glad to take the shuttle. And while you're at it, we have the American Council of Engineering Companies in Minnesota has been wandering the halls today, so if you see somebody who looks like an engineer, pat them on the back, give them a hug, tell them what a nice job they do, and thank them for being here. Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, this is really for Representative Shemansky, because I know Representative Shemansky is new to the committee, but one of the things about the acceleration of MFest was actually your local bus service in your district, mine and in others in greater Minnesota, were suffering severe cash flow problems. Mm-hmm. Wilmer, I think, was another one. And so they had come to us and they said, we need help because we're not going to make it to the end of the fiscal year. So as Mr. Shannon was describing that, I just thought I'd give some context. It was also to help us out of a deep cash flow problem.
Good. Thank you for further illumination, Representative Morrow. I appreciate that. Let's see, while we're moving to public safety, Mr. Jordahl, can you make the audiovisual stuff work? Do you need that, or is...
I think we're going to be good.
We're going to be all right? Okay, we'll give you just a moment there to warm it up. And members, if you move to the public safety portion of your notebook, if you brought it with, and there is also the handout here you can make notes on.
Yeah. I knew it had something to do with research. Yeah. You see the headlines in tomorrow's stuff.
You got her teed up and ready to go, Ms. Ellison?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, we are ready to go. My name is Mary Ellison. I'm acting commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. We did do an overall budget presentation a few weeks ago, but we will go through each of our divisions again, updating with the new information that includes the governor's budget proposals.
Good.
I'm going to go through the entire slideshow, and then we have division directors who are here who are ready to answer questions. And obviously, you can stop me, and we can answer them while I'm going along, or we can save them to the end. It's really your preference.
Unless they get too pesky, I think it's good for the members to ask questions while it's fresh in their mind. And I watch for you to come up for air, then I'll call on them. If that's okay with you, we'll move along like that.
That's fine, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Ms. Ellison, please proceed.
The mission of the Department of Public Safety is to protect citizens and communities, prevent, prepare, respond, recover, educate, and enforce, focus on saving lives, providing efficient and effective services, and maintaining the public trust and developing strong partnerships. The divisions that are under the purview of this committee that are within the Department of Public Safety include the Minnesota State Patrol, Driver and Vehicle Services, the Office of Traffic Safety, the Office of Pipeline Safety, which is in the Fire Marshal's Office, and Administration and Related Services. A summary of the budget proposal, governor's recommending $303.9 million from all funds for the 12-13 biennium. This represents a 0.3% decrease from the 10-11 level, which reflects changes to the forecast base as well as the budget change items. The budget change items, I'll just mention them here and then we'll talk about them a little bit more in detail as we go along. First of all, is a change item to the police and firefighter health care reimbursement program. The next one is a request to extend the DVS technology surcharge as we build out our new MNLAR system for driver and vehicle services. And then we mentioned the armor maintenance and operations because this will be an item that the Minnesota Department of Transportation will talk to you about if they haven't already. First of all, just an overview of the budget for 12 and 13, the budget proposal. It includes $20,812,000 from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, $171,736,000 from the Trunk Highway Fund, a general fund appropriation of $13,174,000, and then miscellaneous special revenue of $98,176,000, or 32%. That miscellaneous special revenue usually jumps out, and that is in large share due to the 911 fee that we collect on cell phones and landlines that we then use for the 911 system and armor emergency communication system. The expenses by category for 12 and 13, payments to individuals of $1,064,000. That includes items like reimbursement for bulletproof vests for law enforcement officers. A transfer to other funds within the state of Minnesota of $4,236,000. Operating, which is everything other than salaries, so rent, things like squad cars, other types of equipment, includes $76,088,000, or 25% of the budget, and then total compensation is $222,510,000, or 74% of the budget. Administration and related services is covered under this division. The information on those services are located on pages 19 to 28 of the budget book. It includes communications.
What pages were those again, Ms. Ellison?
Pages 19 to 28.
Okay, thanks.
Within that area includes the Office of Communications, the Commissioner's Office, Human Resources, Fiscal and Administrative Services, Office of Technology and Support Services are all included in that area. The first change item that I want to describe is the Police Firefighter Health Insurance Program, and it's page 17 of the budget book document. In 1997, Minnesota Statute 299A.465 required cities to continue health insurance coverage for peace officers and then later firefighters and their dependents when officers were disabled or killed in the line of duty. As part of that statute, the legislature appropriated funding to help local units of government continue that health insurance coverage. The program is currently funded through the general fund of $1,376,000 per year. The recommendation from the governor is to amend the use of the firefighter training and education account to include funding this particular item from that account. Next, we move on to the Minnesota State Patrol.
Before you go there, Ms. Mm-hmm. Ellison, I've just heard a little feedback on this. Are you anticipating some little, maybe some controversy or some pushback on using the fire safety account for this? I mean, I can see the nexus here, but it's going to be a change. Are you anticipating any pushback on that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, certainly we will receive some pushback and concern about adding a purpose for use of these funds. The justification is that currently there is projected to be a $9 million balance in that fund by the end of the 12-13 biennium. Now, this is money that isn't currently being appropriated for any particular use. So by using these funds, we save some money in the general fund and continue a program that has, in terms of numbers and projected numbers of officers and firefighters, it just is a very much an increasing program. We're not asking to increase the amount of dollars directed to it, but we are asking that it be paid from this source of funding rather than the general fund.
And I'm thinking about our jurisdiction in this committee. I notice we have pipeline safety, which is sort of related to the state fire marshal, but the recommendation, I believe, is to take this out of the jurisdiction and put it in the fire safety account. What committee has jurisdiction over that account?
Mr. Chair, the Public Safety Committee has jurisdiction over that particular account.
Okay, so then, members, I believe our concern would be to say, let it go and let Public Safety worry about taking it on or something. I'm just thinking here, but okay. But just know that there is a little controversy surrounding that. Our concern will be, do we want to let it go, and we'll let Chair Cornish worry about the other part of it, I guess. Thank you, Ms. Ellison. Please proceed.
Next, we talk about the Minnesota State Patrol. The budget items for the patrol are located on pages 68 to 79. The mission of the patrol is to protect and serve all people in the state through assistance, education, and enforcement, provide support to allied agencies, and provide for the safe, efficient movement of traffic on Minnesota's roadways. The Minnesota State Patrol has 875 full-time sworn and non-sworn personnel. For the 12-13 biennium, they have a budget of $166.2 million from all funds. That includes $158,378,000 from the Trunk Highway Fund, $1,570,000 from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, and $6,290,000 from the General Fund. The State Patrol services mm-hmm. include aviation, capital security, executive protection, the canine program, crash reconstruction, commercial vehicle enforcement, a drug recognition expert program, vehicle crimes unit, DWI enforcement, fleet management, investigative services, public information, a training academy, radio communications, special response team, and then various federal programs that they operate. The next division that we cover is the Office of Traffic Safety. Their budget items are included in pages 98 through 101. The vision of the Office of Traffic Safety is to reduce fatalities and serious injuries to zero on Minnesota's roadways. The mission is to lead efforts to prevent traffic deaths and serious injuries by changing behavior on the roadways in Minnesota.
I know that MnDOT's involved in that as well with some engineering aspects, but judging from the trend lines in traffic deaths in Minnesota over the last 8 or 10 years. It looks like you're doing very good work there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the 12-13 biennium, the budget for the Office of Traffic Safety is $870,000 from the Trunk Highway Fund. These funds are used as a state match to secure $37 million in federal funds.
Would you remind us what we spend those on? the 37 million?
We spend them on various activities related to traffic safety. We have heightened levels of DWI enforcement, heightened levels of speed enforcement. We do that through grants to law enforcement agencies to heighten efforts. We do education programs. We have a program focused on motorcycle safety. That's about all I can think about the top of my head, unless Ms. Marty can come and add to that.
Sure. Ms. Marty, come on down. But maybe at another time, too, we want to hear more about Office of Traffic Safety, perhaps after deadlines. But if you'd like to explain briefly, Cherie, what we do there, that could be helpful to the committee. Welcome.
Thank you. And for the record, my name is Cherie Marty, Director of the Office of Traffic Safety. And as Commissioner Ellison has said, that we do use these federal funds for enhanced enforcement coupled with aggressive public outreach and education. In addition, as Commissioner Ellison has said, we do have a wide array of community outreach efforts, and we do work very closely with the Minnesota Department of Transportation in our Toward Zero Death efforts. So an example would be county highway safety plans in each of the 87 counties. That's a three-year effort that we are partnering with them. We also have community grants working with health, engineering, enforcement, educators in the community about traffic safety and looking at local data and what their particular priorities are and what the countermeasures might be to improve traffic safety in their local community. So in addition to all these outreach efforts, we also have our research function within the office that produces our annual crash facts reports and our annual impaired driving report. That gives communities important information that they need to know what their particular traffic crash factors are in their community and what they can do about it. And there's many, many more special initiatives that I'd be happy to come back and talk about.
If Ms. Ellison would click to the next slide, I think she just gave you just gave her speech there, Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair, I believe she didn't. I'm grateful for that. And you, Mr. Chair, you mentioned Toward Zero Death. Was there a question?
I think I got a couple questions here, but Representative Murray, I think, was up first, and then
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Marty, does your agency then work with seniors and senior driving? I guess the question I come up with, I had some constituents come to me with a traffic death that occurred in Albert Lea last year where a 90-some-year-old woman ran over a senior citizen in a crosswalk and the person died. And I'm wondering what we're doing in those areas as far as education and safety and just looking at senior licensing and things of that nature. Is that something you handle?
Ms. Marty?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murray and members, with respect to older drivers, generally speaking, elderly drivers are very safe drivers. The problem comes in when they are involved in a crash. They're more likely to be injured. They're more likely to suffer serious injury and potentially be fatally injured. So we are currently working with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration as well as the Minnesota Safety Council and AAA of Minnesota. And we are part of a pilot project to develop a elderly driver plan within the state, because this is a growing national concern because of the growing population of aging drivers, and that we need to be more proactive in our planning approaches. So one of our efforts has been to produce an actual DVD program to educate the community on how do you evaluate elderly drivers and their driving skills. And our goal is to truly enable elderly drivers to be as independent as long as possible so that they are safely operating their vehicle. So we have been working closely with Driver and Vehicle Services, and they do the examining and testing of our elderly drivers. But the important thing is for elderly drivers to know what their options are for transportation. So looking at public transit, looking at how can they experience getting out of their vehicle and doing more walking, doing more taking the bus, taking safe alternatives, if they're finding that their skills are not enabling them to navigate the roadway safely. So to answer your question, what we're doing is we are educating on the awareness of this problem and this growing situation of elderly drivers through the DVD program, and we are also a pilot state in developing an effort of how do we plan for our elderly driver population? So that is something that NHTSA is funding for us, and we're working with our partners on that effort.
Just a quick comment, and I in no way want to insinuate that the senior drivers aren't doing a good job, because I think generally they do take more time to get to places and allow for that. And I know a 53-year-old that once in a while makes some bad decisions driving, so mm-hmm. Thank you.
If you want to leave your driver's license with the trooper up back, that'd be fine. Representative Hornstein, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first of all, thank you, Ms. Marty, and your office. I mean, we've worked over the years a lot on distracted driving, and you've been very responsive, helpful, and effective. You had mentioned in the presentation that you get some federal money for your office. And, you know, watching going on with in Washington now, it concerns me that you may be getting those funds cut. I don't know if you have enough information yet about what's going on or what the extent of that cut would be. Do you know yet? And are you concerned about that?
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, as with the state, the federal government is also looking at budget reductions, and we'll be included in those budget reductions. So transportation safety, although a priority for the state DOTs and for the Departments of Public Safety, we will have to look at some tough decisions ahead. What's being discussed right now is we're currently under a continuing resolution until March 4th. Of the federal transportation bill. So at this time, we're not sure what it means, but preliminarily what we're told is we may be going back to 2006 funding levels, and for the next reauthorization and for this current federal fiscal year of FY11, they're looking at a 15% reduction that would be prorated for the full year. So if we are able to pass looking at this this particular federal fiscal year, that decision would be made after March 4th. We would have to go back to the beginning of the federal fiscal year, October 1 of 2010, and we would have to look at a 15% budget reduction in 5 months for the 12 months for the full year. If I explained that clearly, I'm not sure I did.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to get the drift, but Representative Hornstein?
You did, and just one quick follow-up then. Sure. What would that effectively mean then? What would a 15% budget cut for your department mean in terms of programming or staff positions eliminated, et cetera? Would you have any mm-hmm. ballpark sense of that yet?
Ms. Marty, do you have any idea yet?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, we really need to stop and take a look at the crash data and look at what our bigger problems are and continue to try to put more resource towards the bigger problems of lack of seatbelt use, impaired driving, speed, and distracted driving is a growing problem. So while I don't have an immediate answer for you at this time, I do know that we need to go back to the crash data and look at what the bigger problems are and ensure that we are clear on our priorities and that our funding cuts help to protect those clear priorities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Whatever you do, don't text it to Representative Hornstein.
We will not.
I'm kidding. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a follow-up to Representative Hornstein's in that with the money that we get from the federal, are there some strings attached or mandates that are could we expect that if they're going to cut or reduce funding, there are some things that you will not be required to do potentially?
Ms. Marty, ideas?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative. That federal fund that we do receive, currently it's under many different pots of money, and those pots of money are siloed, and they're very limited in how we can expand the use of those funds. So for alcohol, money needs to be spent on alcohol, mm-hmm. and child passenger on child passenger. So it's a bit challenging in terms of if we see a reduction. I do know that for the federal funding, we are required to have a state match of $435,000. That enables us to qualify for all the federal funding. That state match needs to remain. I guess in terms of the requirements for federal funding, what I'm hearing in the future is they're trying to look at potentially more resources going towards distracted driving. But we don't know what it's a bit of a moving target. But certainly more requirements looking at impaired driving and the use of ignition interlocks. That is a kind of an emerging area of attention.
Does that get to good? Thank you. Sorry, I'm trying to manage the clock here while you're talking. Ms. Marty, thank you for your mm-hmm. comments. Any further questions for her before I turn Ms. Marty loose? And I'm going to ask Acting Commissioner Ellison, the next thing you're going to move into is driver and vehicle services, which I think we're going to want to have some dwell time on. So maybe in the next few minutes, we wrap up, maybe Jerry's still here. Could you pull him down, do pipeline safety, and maybe the radio part, the armor thing. And we're anticipating having you back a week from Monday, I think it is. And we'll get into vehicle services and some of that stuff because there'll be some fascinating discussions there. But if I could ask you to leap ahead, and sure, we'll wrap this up in a few minutes for today.
Mr. Chair, then moving ahead to the Office of Pipeline Safety, which is on pages 102 to 104, their mission is to protect lives, property, and the environment through the implementation of a program of gas and hazardous liquid pipeline inspections, enforcement, accident and incident investigations, and education. The request for the 12-13 biennium is $6.3 million in all funds. Basically, their funds come through a mixture of special revenue derived from inspection fees and then federal funds. So they receive $2,708,000 per year in inspection fees and $3.6 million in federal funds. They do pipeline inspections, pipeline incident investigations, enforcement, and damage prevention. So I'm going to ask Mr. Rosendahl to talk just briefly if you have any questions, and then I'll talk about the armor change item.
Good. Mr. Rosendahl, welcome to the committee, and please tell us a little bit about your department and pipeline.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Jerry Rosendahl, State Fire Marshal, and also Director of Pipeline Safety. We have a staff of 17 currently working in the areas that Commissioner Ellison provided, and the mixture of federal funds with state special revenue funds. Mm-hmm. The federal funds come to us based on what they call an interstate agreement with the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. For that, we inspect the pipelines in Minnesota that are interstate lines, and then we go through essentially training towards the Code of Federal Regulations that relate to pipeline safety inspections and regulations, and that's what we enforce. We're essentially the eyes and ears of the federal government on that. The penalties, the enforcement, the investigations that we do, we don't have any authority to change those regulations, certainly, and the penalties that come from an interstate pipeline violation are actually levied, if you will, by the federal government. We provide input on that. So in addition, then, the state special revenue funding that we get comes from a formula that is then develops fees towards the pipeline operators based on the miles of pipeline and the number of meters that are in the state. So no general fund dollars, special revenue, and federal funding. And I'd certainly be happy to answer any other questions.
There's no general fund dollars. We probably won't be seeing you again this spring. But but it's always good to see you, Mr. Rosendahl.
Thank you.
Questions for the pipeline guy and the fire marshal and all-around Civil Air Patrol nice guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Finally, Mr. Chair, we wanted to just make you aware of this change item that you will also be hearing about in the Minnesota Department of Transportation budget presentation. It's on page 13. Mm-hmm. ARMOR is the Allied Radio Matrix for Emergency Response. It's a statewide 800 megahertz interoperable communication system for public safety personnel. We, in partnership with MnDOT, are building out the towers and that system throughout the state of Minnesota. We collect funding, as I mentioned, we collect fees through the 911 or through the fee that's assessed on landlines and cell phones. We collect that fee, we pay MnDOT then to build the towers. And so you will see a budget change item that MnDOT will present. So we're showing you the money going out from public safety and going to MnDOT to continue to build out the armor system.
Is this related to the 800 megawatts deal that we just went through over the last decade, Ms. Ellison?
Mr. Chair, yes. This is about building out that system in the rest of the state.
Representative Benson, I think, is up first, or he's the one I saw first.
It'd probably be the same. That would be the same one. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And that is, I get down in southern Minnesota, we've got a little bit more hills than maybe you do up here. People aren't really particularly happy with the system. Getting pushback, and it's a lot of money, and it doesn't seem to work particularly well in every area. Is there any latitude as far as whether you continue with the system in certain areas or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm going to ask Ron Whitehead, who's currently directing the ECN program, to give you that detail.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Whitehead. I'm the acting director of the Emergency Communication Network. What you're talking about, obviously, is the fact that your terrain in the southern portion of the state is a little bit different. Actually, in 2007, we went back and, on a county-by-county basis, added over 50 towers to the system to assure that every county had at least 95% mobile coverage. The reports we're having right now are that the coverage is better than the predictive models are, and along in southern Minnesota, particularly in the southeast, which was part of phase three, it's completed but for two towers down there. Now, obviously, in the other portion of the southern Minnesota, as you get out towards South Dakota, it actually is fairly flat land and so forth. But we have added towers to the system to assure every county has at least 95% mobile coverage predictably that accounts for the terrain and so forth, and have had very good reports from those that are testing it. Now, is there a chance to change the model? No, we're in the process of implementing that thing. MnDOT is identified building towers. 60 of the towers are actually completed. Most of the other, there'll be 328 towers, are very near completion, or are we've at least identified the land, started clearing that land so we can put towers in. So it's a project, and that MnDOT has now transitioned statewide to the system. State Patrol, by the middle of next summer, will be transitioned statewide to the system. So it's underway. It's nearing completion. 2013 is our deadline to have it basically done, other than a few miscellaneous towers that may take us a little while longer to complete.
Representative Benson.
Just a quick follow-up. The county's putting some money into this, too?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the backbone is paid entirely by the state out of the 911 fund. Counties, when they do come on the system, if they want to add enhancements, they have to buy the enhancements. There are grants available for that, and they have to buy their subscriber radios. But the backbone of the system is totally funded from the special 911 account through revenue bonds, 911 revenue bonds. And as you can see, the operating costs are being funded from that same source. So to a county to operate on the system, there's no charge back for the for operating on the backbone.
Representative Murray.
And my question, just to follow up to Representative Benson's, also with the county funding, maybe portions, if they do enhancements, how about fire departments and other local groups like that? Do they have to pay for some enhancements, and do they bear some of the cost from this also?
Mr. White.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murray, there are, in most cases, the law enforcement is the most demanding requirement. If the county as a whole, transitions over to the armor system, the county will be responsible for the enhancements. I don't know that local fire departments are paying for any. Their primary cost is the cost of radios, okay, what we call subscriber equipment, portables, and mobile radios. In a few occasions, some counties are adding an additional tower to make sure that there's in-building coverage in a particular city. But generally speaking, that's a county responsibility. What we have had very good luck with is when we're dealing with the county boards is to say, counties need to go transition all at once, the entire public safety community. So we've had a lot of good luck with the county board saying, let's put a plan together that accounts for law enforcement, fire departments, EMS within the county to assure that there's the ultimate objective is to have interoperability between all the public safety disciplines so that when they respond, they can talk effectively. And that's what our ultimate objective here has been.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Ellison. And thank you, Mr. Whitehead.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, are there any questions remaining?
I think we're all talked out, at mm-hmm. least for now. We'll ponder this, and when you'll be back, I think the tentative plan is a week from Monday, and we'll take up DVS, and I'm sure we'll be full of questions. Members, if you leave you can take these books with you. They're great reading if you want to take them home with you over the weekend, or if you want to put them right on top of your folder, the staff and pages will put the book in the folder and keep it for you so we can don't have to reproduce these again. Members, nothing else will come before the committee today. I will declare us adjourned.